Kaya, Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boolu, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. We Forgot to Break Up tells the story of fictional Canadian band The New Normals, an indie rock group that transcends labels and definition and changes the scene of indie rock music in the nation. The New Normals is led by Evan, excellently portrayed by Lane Webber, a trans man singer-songwriter who has the big stage in mind all the while trying to navigate his relationship with his girlfriend Isis, June Laporte. Evan finds his relationships tested as the arrival of the new guitarist Lou, Daniel Gravel, catches his attention and possibly affection. We Forgot to Break Up is adapted from Kate Burgess's Heidegger Stairwell and feels pulled directly from an era where each new indie rock song that you heard spoke to your deepest emotions in a way that you'd never expected. The New Normals echoes the great bands of the era, with strains of the broken social scene's guitars being felt throughout the soundtrack. There's a wealth of great original songs too, written by Torkel Campbell from the band Stars. In one of the film's many memorable moments, the band is living in a shared house loft, which acts as a creative space and also a space to earn money too, with bassist Coco, played by Hayley Jones, working as a phone sex worker to bring in money. Her responses to the client on the other end of the line spur Evan into writing a song that then becomes a hit for the band. It's a really, really charming and delightful moment, and one that I really love about the film. In fact, there is a wealth of heart and compassion within We Forgot to Break Up, but it's also a film that really sinks in its fingers into the dirt and vibe of the indie rock scene, with director Knox pulling from the aesthetic of the celebrated documentary Dig. And with that in mind, We Forgot to Break Up really leans into that lived-in feeling that that particular documentary has, making the film almost feel like a documentary at times. And in turn, it gives space to let the lives of queer folk who make up the cast and characters simply live as they want to. While this is, ostensibly, a film about queer folks, their queer identity is not the main focus of the film. And that in itself is a refreshing, invigorating act of resistance. In the following interview with Knox and Lane, recorded ahead of the film's launch at the Queer Screen Mardi Gras Film Festival on Tuesday, the 18th of February, where they both will be in attendance for a Q&A, we chat about the creation of the film, the choices of songs featured, and how that lived-in feeling was created on screen. We close the chat by talking about what it means to be able to tell Canadian queer stories on screen right now. Look, I had an absolute ball watching We Forgot to Break Up. I lapped up its wicked guitar licks and band drama, and all the while, I managed to lose myself with the excellent performances and the sublime direction. And that was just from watching it at home, so I can only imagine what the experience will be like getting to see it in a full audience. With that in mind, if you're in Sydney and you can, make sure to pick up your tickets to We Forgot to Break Up via queerscreen.org.au. You won't want to miss it. And as you'll hear from the following chat, getting to talk with Knox and Lane about the film and getting to meet them in person would be an absolute delight. They're really wonderful people. I really enjoyed my time being able to chat with them about it, and they had so much to say about the film. I hope you enjoy this following chat. And look, if you enjoy the chats that I do and other writers and people on The Curb do, then please head over to thecurb.com.au. We are completely independent ad-free website that lives on the support of listeners and readers just like yourself. So if you can and you have the means to, please visit patreon.com/thecurb.au to support our work from as little as $1 a month. Right, here is a clip from We Forgot to Break Up, followed by my interview with Knox and Lane.
You know, realistically, most high school bands never actually make it anymore, right?
Morning changes, it's mine.
Yeah, except Radiohead. The Cure, Green Day. Baby, let's go to Toronto.
What did we come here honestly to do? Because I thought we came here to be a band.
If something changes for you about us, you would tell me, right?
Trust me when I say no one has seen anything like you.
I thought we could talk about what happened
on the record.
What I kind of want to start talking about is the origins of We Forgot to Break Up. I know that it's adapted from a book, is that correct? And if yeah. so, what was that adaptation process like for you, Knox?
Mm-hmm. So it's based on a novel called Heidegger's Stairwell, written by Kate Burgess. And that book was optioned by the producer, Nicole Hilliard Ford, 10 years ago, which seems crazy. But she read the book, Nicole, about a decade ago and totally fell in love with it. And I can completely understand why. It's a really cool novel. Just like a little context on the novel was part of a competition in Canada where novelists have to write a book in a week. So it really, like, the propulsion of this novel, like, it really does feel almost like a stream of consciousness, and like the story is just sort of like flowing out of the author. And the book actually spans about two decades in this band's trajectory. So there is the sort of like the origin story in Emmett Lake, their move to Toronto. But then there's another chapter that is not explored in this book at all, which takes place almost entirely in a hotel room in Berlin. And it's a really, really cool part of the novel. And I have this fantasy now where like 20 years from now or 15 years from now, I make like a Linklater style durational sequel to We Forgot to Break Up. And it's the exact same cast. And we all just go and film a movie in a hotel room in Berlin. So Nicole first made a short film version of this story, directed by Chandler Levac, which premiered at TIFF, I think it was 16. And then decided that she wanted to make the feature version of it. And Chandler was away, busy doing other incredible Canadian things. She's an amazing Canadian film director as well. And so approached me to direct the feature version of it. And the script also, it was written by three different people. It found like it's quite a process, like finding exactly what component of this story I think needed to be told for this film. So worked with three different writers on adapting the script. And then when I got brought on, I was working with the final writer on the script, Noel Barker. And we were just kind of getting it into shooting shape. And that was a really fun process, because when I started thinking about this script and how it was going to translate on screen, I started watching a lot of band documentaries from that time period, from the early 2000s. And the two that really stood out to me were Tondi Ortimer's Dig! Which won a bunch of awards at Sundance when it first came out, and the Oasis documentary Supersonic. And the thing that I really responded to in those documentaries was the use of footage that had been recorded by the band, because it made it so personal. Like, immediately I knew who these people were and I understood the dynamic between the band members so quickly, because when you're like handy camming each other, there's a relational aspect that happens between the people where you understand why they hate each other, why they love each other, how they annoy each other, what kind of like grudges or inadequacies people feel. It's very revealing of both the person who is filming and the person who's being captured. So,
especially in that time too.
Totally.
Like, prior to social media, and like no one thinking like, oh, I'm on camera, like people are gonna see this. They're just reacting.
They're just being themselves, exactly. Like, it's so funny to see the difference between the way people behaved on camera then and the way people behave on camera. It is like, now you put a camera on and it's like, the world is going to see this. But in Dig, it's like, these people are being crazy and so authentic. It really does feel so realistic. Noel and I worked on sort of incorporating more of that language into the shooting script. And then the actors were incredible in terms of just adding a lot of like improvisational stuff. When we were shooting the film, we had two Sony Handycams, one that was for production and one that I just gave to the cast. And I was like, please shoot everything. I was like, I don't care if it's like a little anachronistic in terms of like stuff you're catching in the background. I just want like unlimited footage of you guys hanging out and being with each other and just like doing shit. And they delivered hardcore. There's like hours and hours and hours of footage that I have that didn't make the cut of the band just like hanging out. But so much of what they shot ended up in the film and really, I think, helped fill out the world in a really interesting and I think authentic way. So that was kind of development on a script level.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And as you're saying, like that stream of consciousness vibe is really, really tangible in it. Lane, I know you're born around the 2000s, is that right? So effectively the era that this is set. I'm curious for you as an actor what it's like to be able to step into something that's like a generation before you and understanding and seeing like the different styles of, as you're talking about, like filming things and interacting with one another with a camera and stuff. Like that's a whole different kind of landscape. What was it like for you to step into that world?
It was fun. It was like, I feel like my first bits of consciousness as a human, the media I was consuming at that time would have been what is the time that we were like portraying. So it was kind of like a dream kind of scenario where you're like putting yourself in like the first bits of like representation that you were consuming, if that makes sense. Like, the first people I saw on TV, I'm like, they're so cool. Like, that was who I was portraying. Especially that like indie punk rock kind of scene was something that I was very drawn to as like a young child. So to be able to like be that in that time was really cool. There's a lot of things we had to like be aware of, like the whole like band cast, just in the way we were speaking, especially in those like handycam moments, like being very cautious of the slang we were using and references we were making and the way that even just inflections of certain words that are just like very 2020 coded. It was very conscious efforts and like just doing little bits of research to try and throw in little references of like what was going on in 2001. So that was definitely something that we had to be like specifically aware of, but it was easier than doing, you know, something like super period for sure. No, it was really fun. I liked the challenge.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like I'm 40 years old now. So thinking of the 20, you know, the 2000s, the turn of the century kind of thing as being period is a bizarre concept for me, but it's a reality, right? And that's what I love about getting to see this is we're getting to see a slice of the world, but we're also getting to see in a very familiar concept, which is the music. And there is something about that particular style of indie rock music, which spoke to so many different people. You could find yourself in the songs, some of them that we're getting to hear and some of them are obviously made for the film, which getting to hear those songs that are made for the film, they're equally, I'm a bit like, gosh, I wish I'd heard that back in the 2000s. That would have just been something I would have listened to on repeat. Let's talk about that music. What's it like exploring that and getting to hear that and I guess kind of getting to recontextualize some of the songs for a film like this?
Lane, what are you?
Really cool.
Yeah. Talk about some music that you hadn't encountered before the movie.
Mm-hmm. So we had Torquil Campbell from Stars, Broken Social Scene. As the music guy for the film, he was writing all the music and he was very collaborative and very open. Like he wasn't married to anything. Like he had his ideas, but he was like, you're singing it. What do you think? Like just completely open to criticism. And not that I had a whole bunch for him or anything, but he was just very like, let's make this what you want to make it. And he was very, very cool to work with. And so basically he like wrote these songs and sent them to me prior to like going into rehearsals and stuff and was like, what do you think? Like, do you want to change anything? Like, and I remember the first song I heard was Goodbye Anthem, which is, I think, the first song that we hear in the movie from the band as well. And off the bat, it was giving me U2 vibes. And I really like U2. So I was like, okay, I can rock with this. Like once we had like the three, I think it was the three main songs, we went into like a studio for a couple days and just recorded like our version of, because we obviously got the songs with Torquil singing on them, So we went in and we recorded Evan on them, and that was really cool, because it was like not necessarily how I sing. I was very much leaning into the vibe of the band that I perceived, and it was really like fun, just like, because as an actor, you're taking on different characters all the time, but unless you're in theater, I feel like you don't do that as a singer all the time, taking on different characters and different voices. And so to do that as a singer, without it being super campy was like really fun. But yeah, I ultimately just really loved the songs and like loved the vibe for that band for that time. And once we got to like filming with it, I felt like I had really like known the songs by that point, because like we all brought our instruments up to North Bay where we were filming. We all lived in the same space and we were just practicing the songs all the time so that it would look legit when we were playing. So by the time we went to filming, like we had known those songs like so well. And they had like given a meaning to us, and we fell in love with them in our own ways. And yeah, it just felt like so cool. Like the way that when I was a kid, I would stand in front of the mirror with my Rock Band guitar and pretend that I was in Mariana's Trench or whatever. It felt like I was living out that dream when we were like doing the performance scenes or the rehearsal scenes in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah, I think like, I mean, huge shout outs to Torkel Campbell of Stars, who wrote the original music for the movie. It, like figuring out the music with him was kind of a dream for me. I mean, when I was a teenager, I was a huge Stars fan. Like I remember like lying on the floor of my bedroom, staring at the ceiling, like playing Set Yourself on Fire over and over and over again. And so then, you know, being an adult and being like, wow, I can work with this person on like an art project that I want to make. Like, this is a fucking dream come true. And Torque is so, he's what a guy. Like, he's absolutely nuts. And he lives on the West Coast of Canada. I live on the East Coast. And so we were sort of collaborating like across coasts. And he's kind of like, he's the kind of guy that is like, what'd you dream about last night? Like as an in for like how to talk about like what the songs should sound like. And like that's sort of his entry point. So he's, you know, he's very like, his music comes from a very emotional place. And I think we really connected too, because he's a theater guy too. So he understands music, I think, like on a story level as well. And I think his lyrics are really indicative of that. I think his lyrics are like, they're poetry. They're so beautiful. And I think a lot of the lyrics that he wrote for the songs in this movie too, were just like really like spicy and fun. And it was so funny because I remember I sent him like some lyrics that like, I was like, if you want to like riff on these or whatever, and then he took them and he made them 8,000 times better. And I was like, oh, that's what a musician does. That's really cool. But yeah, it was interesting, like finding the sound of this band. And I think, you know, Stars was always sort of the band that we were like, okay, yeah, we kind of want them to sound like Stars. And it's interesting because like Stars is like, it's soft music. Like it's not super rock and roll. Like it is. And that time period of music in Toronto too, like if you look at the other sort of, you know, heavy hitters from that era, like Broken Social Scene, or like, I mean, Mariana's Trench is like a little more like rock and roll, but it's all like, yeah, it's rock music, but it's soft indie rock music. And like figuring out how to put that on screen in like an interesting way, like it's not punk, right? Like it's not like high energy, high intensity, like it is like a little bit more it's a little quieter and it's a little more like let us bring you in. And I think like for me as a filmmaker, having to like figure out how like the way of capturing the subtlety of that was interesting, because I think, you know, my impulse is to always go towards like high intensity, like fast cuts, like I like violent sounding songs. So it was interesting figuring out the context of that. And yeah.
One of the things I really love, and I think I'm going to be thinking about this for a very long time, is the recontextualization of Pixie's song, Here Comes Your Man. And like getting to hear that from a trans man is like, wow, that in itself is, you hear, it's like hearing it for the first time, right? And that is a beautiful moment, which sets the scene for the band itself and getting to understand what kind of music they want to be able to perform. What was it like choosing that song, performing that song, deciding that Here Comes Your Man was going to be kind of one of the first things that we hear from the band?
Yeah, I mean, it's a Canadian song, and we wanted, like, I worked with a music supervisor who I also love so much. His name is Michael Perlmutter. He's an absolute legend and like the GOAT in Canada when it comes to music supervision. And for a long time, I wasn't sure. There were a lot of songs that I wanted that were not Canadian songs. Like there was one song, a White Stripes song, Seven Nation Army, that I was like obsessed with getting for this movie because it felt like so quintessential for the time period for me in this film. And I like wrote this like long impassioned letter to Jack White to like beg him to let us use the song because he has very specific guidelines about use of music in his films and he has to personally approve everything. So I wrote him the letter and ultimately he said yes, but the song ended up being way too expensive. And that was kind of a crossroads moment where I went back to my music supervisor and I was like, you know what? No American songs. They all have to be Canadian. And, you know, this was prior for us to us picking Here Comes Your Man. But I think that that song, like, it's just, number one, it's a beautiful song. And it was written, I think, oh my God, how old was he when he wrote that song? I feel like he was like 19 when he wrote Here Comes Your Man.
It's nuts.
So it was like one of his, I think it was like one of their first big hits. And he was super young, he wrote it. And I think the fact that he was so young when he wrote it too was like something that like really spoke to me. I was like, this is the song of like a young genius who is like about to explode into the world. So it felt thematically like very appropriate in that regard as well. And I love the use of the song in the beginning, but I think my favorite use of the Here Comes Your Man song is in the end when Evan is singing it quietly to himself in the car when he's driving back to Emmett Lake to reunite with his band. And I think for me, that was sort of like, it was this beautiful bookend moment. And that I think we just came up with on the day, right, Lane? I was just like, why don't you sing Here Comes Your Man in the car? Mm-hmm. And it felt like one of those kismet moments that like, we hadn't planned it, but I was like, oh my God. I was like, this is like the kind of, you know, bookended use of the song that I want because, you know, Evan's journey to become like an adult is really, I think, sort of like cemented in that like use of that. It's like, here comes your man to him in Emmett Lake when he's about to leave for Toronto and like grow up and become the person that he's meant to be is a very different performance of that song than when he's singing it, you know, on the way back. And it really is like Odysseus coming home from his odyssey. It is very like the prodigal son returns. And it just felt like, I remember getting chills in the car when we were filming that. And I was like, this is the use of the song that was supposed to happen.
To me, it feels like in that moment that you're talking about that, like he's singing it to himself. Like he's singing it. Mm. He's not singing it to anybody else. He's saying like, Here I am now. This is who I'm meant to be. This is who I've always wanted to be. Is that something you felt at all, Lane? Or am I kind of reading a little bit and applying too much of myself onto that?
To me, it feels kind of like, it feels like it's, can be read in two ways. It feels kind of like a, ironic is the wrong word, but like a kind of, I don't know a better word to use than ironic, like a with attitude kind of like he's singing it to Emmett Lake because he's kind of at this point being dragged back home. He didn't want to go necessarily, or I guess he did, but like it's because of the circumstance. And if it were up to him and if the circumstance weren't apparent, like he would just still be in Toronto. And so he's like, okay, fine, I'm coming back. Also, he doesn't know what he's coming back to. Whether that's going to be open arms or kind of just disregard from his family, from his bandmates, from the other people of the town. So it's like kind of like, I guess, vulnerable and like, okay, well, you know, I'm coming. This is what you wanted. Like, but hopefully, I don't know. That's kind of how it feels to me. But also, a bit to himself, as you said, almost as like a pep talk. Like, he is that man now. Like, he's been through some shit, and he's kind of got an idea of who he is. Maybe not as much as he's hoped at that point, but like definitely a lot different than when he left. He's like kind of saying to himself, okay, I'm going. I kind of know who I am. Like, okay, at least I have that. It's a bit of both of those things to me. A pep talk and also like a vulnerability.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like songs mean different things at different times in our lives, right? And we evolve as they evolve. And that's what I found really beautiful about Revolutionary Heart. Like when we first hear that and then the evolution of that as a song in the film is beautiful because we're getting to see the band change and them change and hear it from different contexts, what it means originally to what it means when we later hear it is beautiful. Can you talk about that concept of songs meaning different things at different times of their lives?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like you should talk about the song that you and Lou write together.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking, the Too Much and Not Enough. I feel like that means so many things, that song.
Yeah.
It's a song about ISIS. It's a song about Lou. It's a song about Evan. It's a song about Toronto. It's a song about transition. It's a song about all of the things that Evan needs and wants at that time. And like ISIS's response to like hearing the song, like pointing out certain lines, like, is that about us? And like him going, not everything that passes through my brain is about us. And it like definitely is about them, but I don't even know if like Evan realized that when he was writing it, because he was so like stuck in this bubble with Lou. But yeah, just like the version that we see when the band is rehearsing it into when we see it in the music video, I feel like it has a very different energy. I mean, by this point, like Evan has become his like angsty, neglectful self. And I think you can see that in his like performance of it, and potentially he's singing about fame at this point and not about either of like any of the bandmates. He's singing about like how badly he needs to be more famous and more rich and more this and that and have more adrenaline and more high. That maybe that's what it's about at that point. That's what it feels like to me. Yeah, that's definitely one of those songs that's like constantly evolving. And I think giving you where the character's at. Mm-hmm. Like I think a lot of, even just like each song being written, like for the audience being introduced to each new song and those like title cards that come up with the song, I feel like are like something I really like about the movie and how it like shows us where we're at, just like the credits for the songs.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah, and who wrote that? I think if I can add to that, I think a lot of the time with music, and this happens in art too, like filmmaking, writing, etc. A lot of the time, because the creation of art is mysterious, and a lot of the time the muses speak to us and we don't actually understand what they're saying until it reveals itself to us later. And I think that like in this instance, you know, Evan, when he was writing Too Much and Not Enough, yeah, it was about Lou to start. It was about Lou and ISIS. And then for it to become this thing about fame, it's oftentimes it's like art comes to us when we need it, but it's also expressing something that we don't fully understand yet ourselves. And it is through the creation of art that we are trying to understand something that we're grappling with. And I think that that happens to me all the time when I'm like working on movies, on writing projects. I find that like things that I'm writing about serendipitously start to occur in the real world. And I think that a lot of the time that's like the unconscious artist's brain trying to work out exactly what they're trying to say. So I find that like even on film sets, a lot of the time, like certain power dynamics or relational dynamics or existential crises or tragedies that occur in the narrative of scripts have a way of working themselves into the crew dynamics of what you're trying to make, or, you know, with your creative partners or whatever. And really that's the artist's way of being like, what exactly am I trying to say here? And if I experience this, and it's usually on an unconscious level, it's not like people are trying to create drama or like going out as mercenaries being like, I'm going to figure out what I'm saying by like stirring up some drama in my life. But it's a way of like unconsciously trying to see what it is exactly that you're trying to say. And it's mysterious too. I think some of it is the artist like consciously being drawn towards that. And then some of it I think is this like mysterious other thing where it just inserts itself into your life in a way that is like both helping you and forcing you to contend with the piece of art that you're trying, with the story that you're trying to tell.
I'm curious then to kind of bounce off that. As a director, you're getting to see some really raw emotional moments there. And you know, I'm not trying to make the film out to be like this extreme drama or anything like that. It's full of so much joy and love and happiness and stuff. Yeah. But those are pretty intense emotions at times. What's it like for you as a director knowing that you've captured that from your actors on set and they're having those emotional moments in front of you? What's that like for you?
I mean, I'm an actor's first director. I always have been because I'm an actor myself. And that is like, I really believe that if you aren't getting those performances, then like you're cooked. Like there are some directors who, it was really funny. I was actually having lunch with another director friend of mine who was saying that he was really excited to work with, he comes from sort of like the indie world too. He's saying that he was really excited to work with like some really pro actors because he's about to make like a pretty fancy movie with a big budget and some like kind of stars. And he's so excited to work with pro actors because then he can just let the actors do their thing so he can focus on the important stuff. And I was like, what? I was like, bro, what are you talking about? Because like the thing that I, like the only thing that I'm like, not the only thing, but the thing that I'm like primarily interested in as a director is like finding the human core and the like the truth of the emotion on screen. So I am not a Video Village director. I am like always like breathing down the neck of my cinematographer, like looking at the shot, like trying to like be in concert and conversation with the actors on set. Because that's the stuff that I live for. And I think that, you know, and I think with indie films too, it's like, use what you have. And if you have amazing actors, which I did on this movie, it was like, that's a resource where you can make a banging piece of art and it doesn't cost anything. It just takes time and like a little bit of consideration and like, you know, really concerted work in terms of figuring out like what the emotional truth and core of this is. So I think like indie cinema filmmakers, like take note, like it's all about capturing the truth of humanity because you can do that for almost no money and make it look beautiful. So yeah, it was a dream. Like the actors on this movie, like the top five who play, everybody was great, of course, but I'm like so indebted to like the five, New Normals actors because they just like, every single one of them gave it 110%. Like they were so down. And as Lane mentioned earlier, they also all agreed to live together in a loft. Like basically we were, the loft that we built for their apartment in the movie, they were all living above that in a different, like slightly nicer loft. But the fact that they were all like down to do that so that they could sort of like live the experience of all like living together and really kind of like lean into the authenticity of, you know, figuring out what it's like to like be in this dynamic was really a gift because, you know, there's like some actors who would just simply not be down for that at all. So I was like, it was a really special experience for me as a director. Really lucky.
And for Lane, as you as an actor, like having that kind of space to have that kind of explore that kind of relationship with your fellow actors, what's that like?
It was really nice, especially for me. Like I was very intimidated going into this. I acted before, but like anything I've kind of dip my toe in has been either like very lighthearted or like kids content or like a comedic kind of situation. And so I feel like I've never been forced to like actually like dig into like the depth of who a character is or just like show any other emotions other than like silliness and joy. So I was definitely very scared, like even just like the car ride up to North Bay with the five. We're all talking, everyone's talking about like their favorite films and their inspirations and dream characters to play. And I was just kind of feeling like, oh, what am I doing here? Like, but they didn't make me feel like that. Like they were so supportive and like made me feel very great. But just living with them was also like helping that. And just everyone being vulnerable by literally just sharing space together where we were getting ready for work. And then on the weekends, just like hanging out. And like I said, we had all our instruments there. So in our free time, we were just like jamming a lot. And with the Handycam, capturing content in character and also kind of out of character sometimes, we very much kind of blended the two. Even just the way that we got ready in the morning, like I was very observant of like how we would spend our time in the loft. And how it kind of just like completely aligned with how our characters would. It was cool getting to like share that extra space with them, because it was never like we were running lines together, but we were definitely doing something subconsciously that was, for me at least, solidifying how I was gonna go in the next day and perform. So that was very like solidifying for me. And then particularly having Knox as a director. She's someone I have worked with before as a director. Again, more so in those like fun, silly kind of situations. But as she said, like being kind of like an actor's first director was huge, obviously, for the actors. and like getting like, oh, can I do that again? Like, you don't always get to do that again, you know what I mean? Or just like the particular feedback that she was giving us after a take. Knox, I know, was able to, like, there are a couple times where I was like, oh, that's cool that you can do that. Like, being like, how did you feel when this happened? Like, just knowing certain things about my life and being like, pull from this. Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's cool. But aside from, like, knowing me, like, just knowing the right things to say versus like someone who's maybe coming from an editing background or a camera background or whatever it is. It just like, as an actor, I felt very seen under Knox. And that and living with the band, I feel like was like the perfect kind of like preparation for me to do a good job. And feel very comfortable doing so.
Well, as you were saying before, Knox, like referring to like Dig and the Oasis documentary, there is almost this documentary vibe to the film where you're feeling like it's lived experience, right? We're getting to see that on screen. It feels organic and natural. And you can't really, I mean, acting is part of making that feel real, but it's hard to imitate that. It comes from a place of authenticity and it comes from heart, right? And as we lead into wrapping up, one of the things I'm curious about in a sense of, like I cover usually Australian films and other sorts of films, usually not American films. So it's a delight to be able to talk to Canadian storytellers because we don't really get to see Canadian stories down under really all that often, right? And there's a certain style to Australian stories, just as there's a certain style to Canadian stories. And that's part of, you know, where the heart comes from as well, is getting to tell a Canadian story, a story about your own home, about, you know, a story that you can relate to. And so with that in mind, what does it mean to be able to tell queer Canadian stories right now and being able to put it on screen and having it travel around the world and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, with Donald Trump currently trying to, tell Canadians that he wants us to become the 51st state, like, it was really funny when that, I don't know, insane comment dropped, because it was just like, it really, like, you know, Canada, like, we're not like rah-rah patriotism. That's never really been our style. We're kind of like quietly like, this is what we do. And like, you know, but at that point I was just kind of like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, get out of here, bro. Like, what? And it was like, it really kind of like fired a patriotic bone in my body. And I was like, no, like, there is a culture here, because I think a lot of the time, like, especially English speaking Canada, we can be a bit down on ourselves in terms of like, oh, we don't really have an identity. We're kind of just like the kid brother to America and we're always trying to be like, do you think we're cool? Do you think we're cool? French Canada has its own thing going on, and like being like, Quebecois film scene is amazing, and like I wish we, you know, could sometimes take a page out of their book. But there is a Canadian identity in cinematic storytelling, and I think that we're starting to find that more now. I think that there's a really cool indie scene happening, especially in our city, in Toronto. I mean, it's happening across Canada, but I mean, I'm really like boots on the ground here in Toronto, being involved in it. And it's hard for me to like put into words like describing what it is, but I think that We Forgot to Break Up fits really nicely into it, in that it's a little bit countercultural, and it's a little bit like bizarre. It's kind of like how I sort of like to describe it. I mean, we're definitely a nation of like comedians. I think that there's a strong like satirical funny bone that this nation has that is not really done anywhere else. And not that there is like, you know, a ton of comedy and We Forgot to Break Up, but I think it's still there. And I think that, you know, I think this movie is like a really good representation of the kinds of stories that are like uniquely Canadian and are really like fucking kick ass and like can stand up to like the American sort of like, you know, movie machine system. You know, in terms of like the queer storytelling thing, you know, I feel similarly, like it's, you know, it's so hard to watch the world. I mean, the West particularly like take steps backwards in terms of, you know, what the sort of dominant cultural drone note is. And right now it does feel like we're regressing to more conservative, whiter, straighter sort of overall feeling in terms of cultural supremacy. So I think it's like one of those things where it's like, yeah, we keep telling those stories, and in a way that is, I think, undeniably cool and undeniably artistically relevant. Because I think that like art as a revolutionary tool is really the only revolutionary tool that I understand personally. Because I think that art is deeply political, irrespective of whether or not you're discussing politics in it, the fact of its existence, specifically, I think this story is a really good example of that. It's not a political movie, but the fact that it exists is really fucking political. And to have that movie scream globally, in like all kinds of corners of the world, it makes me feel really hopeful that, you know, we take two steps forward, we take three steps back, but next time, you know, that still means we get to take two more steps forward, and it means that we're pushing things forward just a little bit more. So I think it's good work. It's drudge work. It feels like I want this to like not be a thing anymore, but I feel like it's always going to be a thing. So yeah, that's what I would say. Lane, what you have anything to say?
Yeah, I'll just add what I've been saying, which is you've said a bit of it. How much I'm appreciative that this is one of those films that is queer because it is, not because it's like it's not a political film, but it's political because it exists, kind of vibe what you just said. But yeah, like it's not a trans story, it's not a gay story, but it is because they are. But that's not the plot. Like, there's a couple moments where we're like, it's relevant because that's a part of their life. Like, these things do happen because that's who I am. But it's not, Evan's not discovering that part of himself in the film. He's discovering different parts of himself. He's, and same with, I saw something written somewhere yesterday where Lou was referred to as Angus's gay brother, and I thought that was really funny, because I don't think anywhere in the film does it say that. It's not true, but it, we don't really know what Lou is, but no one's asking him. He's just, they're concerned that there's a little bit of an affair happening. They're not concerned about the gender of the affair partner. But yeah, I'm just like, happy to be a part of something like that, because I do think that's an important like brick in building like the normalcy of queerness and on the screen, is making it normal before, like, not having to tell people it's normal, just making it normal.
Totally.
So yeah, that's my bit.
I love that. And as you're saying, like, because it is a queer story, it is like, but it's not part of that. Like, it is, it's not the point of the film. The point is about a band. And that's what resonates the most for me, is like, I've watched a lot of queer films. I love queer cinema and getting to see all different kinds of it, but getting to see a film where people just exist, you know, and are just living a life and doing what they want to do and making really fucking cool music as well. Like, that in itself is just like, oh, I want more of that. Thanks. Like, it's just beautiful. Like, it's a wonderful film to spend time with. I'm glad it exists. I'm glad that you're storytellers and being able to tell these stories out in the world. I want to seek out more of your work. So yeah, thank you for the film. Thank you for your time. It's been a delight to be able to talk with you both, Knox, Lane.
And thank you, Andrew. That was a really stimulating conversation. I was like, I hope I got my words straight, but that was really lovely. Great questions.
Thanks again for listening to this interview with Knox and Lane as they chat about their film, We Forgot to Break Up, which screens at the Mardi Gras Queer Screen Film Festival on the 18th February 2025. Tickets are available via queerscreen.org.au. Check out other interviews that I've done via thecurb.com.au, and I will see you on the next one.